This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's kind of a tradition on Fresh Air to end the year with 10 best lists. But because we're also ending the century, the lists have expanded. We've asked our film critic John Powers to choose the 10 best films of the year and the 10 films of the century that he'd like to have with him if he were stuck on that proverbial desert island. Let's start with John's list of the 10 best films of the year.
I should say that I haven't ranked them 1 to 10, and I know that that often drives people crazy, but frankly, this was a year where I really just couldn't tell the difference between number 5 and number 8, so I decided to do it alphabetically. And the 10 films are these: All About My Mother by Pedro Almodovar, Being John Malkovich, the film that stars John Malkovich playing himself, Kevin Smith's film Dogma, the Japanese film Dr. Akagi by Shohei Imamura. Perhaps my favorite film of the year, which is Election, which is a film about a high school election starring Matthew Broderick and the wonderful Reese Witherspoon. The Jane Campion film Holy Smoke, which will be opening wider in the country in the middle of January and is in some ways perhaps the most brilliant film of the year. The Insider, the story about 60 Minutes and the tobacco whistleblower, which I think is a very enjoyable, important film that for some reason nobody wants to see. I Stand Alone, in some ways the most tautly and brilliantly made film of the year, a French nihilist film about an angry butcher. Rosetta, a left-wing film about a young woman who's trying to find work in Belgium. And finally, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I think had the swooningly enjoyable pleasures of old Hollywood.
Well, I'm really delighted to see Election on your list. I thought that was such a really entertaining and well-made movie and gave a really good part for Matthew Broderick, who was so much fun to watch.
It was. Well, I think Matthew Broderick, you know, has been caught in that old truth that physiognomy is destiny. And because he has that particular face, I think he ran the risk of playing boyish 20-year-olds until he was 90. But in this film, he finally gets to be old and older and slightly seedy and disreputable, and all those nice guy qualities contain something deeper and darker. And he really gives a really good performance. And Reese Witherspoon is really terrific as the ambitious student Tracy Flick. It's not easy to play that kind of role and sustain it and keep it enjoyable all the way through. But she's really terrific in the film. And if you've seen her in other work, you realize that this bears no relationship to who she actually is. And she plays this part so well that I think many people in the audience were like, this must be what she's actually like. She's not like this.
Now, ever since you reviewed I Stand Alone, I've been wanting to see it. I don't think it ever opened where I live in Philadelphia. Has it come to the States?
It has come to the States. It played in 2 or 3 cities. But I think that we're not in a time where nihilistic French films about hate-filled butchers are ever going to get wide release in this country. It's too bad. Eventually, it will come out on video. And I would think that people should try to see it then. It's so intense in the theater that maybe people will be happier seeing it on a video screen. You know, there's a moment in the film where the director has put across the screen, you have 30 seconds to leave the theater because you know something so terrible is going to happen that you don't want to see it. And on the screen, it starts counting down 29, 28, 27. And when it shows in a theater, you can see people writhing in their seats in horror at what's going to happen.
Well, now that you've given us your picks of the best films of the year, how would you describe the year? Would you say overall it was a good year for films?
It was actually a very good year for films. If you drop off the first few months of the year, where I think nothing good played, at least nothing good American played until The Matrix, it's actually been quite a good year, starting with The Matrix and Election, which are very enjoyable, skillful films. And then working through the rest of the year, you had films like Boys Don't Cry and Being John Malkovich and Dogma and The Insider and Three Kings and American Beauty that were, by the standards of the last few years, extremely good for American films. In lots of ways, American film did very, very well this year, and the studios did very, very well this year. Although I probably overpraised the film along the way, American Beauty is not the kind of film you would think that DreamWorks would make. I mean, DreamWorks is the company that gives you Jurassic Park-y kind of films, and suddenly they're making this film. I don't really associate Warner Brothers with films about the Gulf War, and yet there they were making Three Kings. So in that respect, it was a very good year for film.
What are some of the movies that surprised you or surprised the industry during the year?
Yes. Well, I think probably in one way, one of the biggest surprises was American Beauty, just because it turned out to be so popular. I think that there was a general thought that a sort of metaphysical black comedy with sad overtones set in the suburbs was the kind of film that maybe three or four critics would like and then would die when it got out to the rest of the country. So I think that probably the people were most surprised by that. The other film that surprised people a lot was The Matrix. And I think The Matrix is one of the year's great phenomena because it managed to steal the thunder of Phantom Menace. I think when people look back on this year, what they will realize is that Phantom Menace made all the money this year. It was the big money maker. Yet the film that changed the culture was The Matrix, which came out a little bit before. Because The Matrix was hip and The Phantom Menace was a triumph of merchandising.
I think a couple of the other big surprises was The Sixth Sense, which was this huge box office hit for a very long time, and Blair Witch. What do you have to say about how they did and what impact they're having?
Yes. Well, these two supernatural films, The Blair Witch Project and Sixth Sense, set the industry on its ear in a way. Blair Witch, for reasons that have a little bit less to do with art than with marketing, this was the film that seemed to come from nowhere. It was made very cheaply using digital or video technology and then marketed through the internet and became such a huge phenomenon that I think it caused almost everyone in Hollywood to think, oh my God, we've been doing it the wrong way. The world is changing. We've got to catch up. This movie cost a few hundred thousand dollars altogether and it's making hundreds of millions of dollars. The other film that's connected to this is The Sixth Sense, which was a moody, slow horror film that wasn't about scaring you. And I know that as a person who was trying to see it for months and months, you kept hearing, that Disney doesn't like the film, that Disney doesn't know what to do with the film, that Disney has no confidence in the film. And you could almost tell that from the way that it was marketed. This wasn't a film that you felt as though you'd seen before it opened. They didn't bombard you with advertising. And what that meant was the audience was allowed to discover the film for itself. And it was probably the great word-of-mouth film of 1999. Just week after week, the amount of money that it made kept steady because people would go and like it and tell their friends. And I think one of the things that's happening now in our increasingly advertising and corporate-dominated culture is that audiences like to find movies for themselves. And when they find one, like The Sixth Sense, they're incredibly loyal to it. And when they feel as though they're being force-fed something like Wild Wild West, unless they love it, they reject it almost totally.
Who do you think gave the outstanding performances of the year?
Yeah. I think the best performance I saw this year by anyone was by Om Puri in a film called My Son the Fanatic, which was a little film that Miramax brought out and essentially didn't show many places, where he played a taxi driver whose son becomes an Islamic fundamentalist. And he, meanwhile, is in love with a prostitute. It's an absolutely brilliant performance, by far the best performance I saw this year, and almost no one saw it. Among the performances that people have seen by men, I thought Russell Crowe in The Insider gave the best one. He was extraordinarily good playing a wounded, intelligent, prickly man who's trying to do the right thing while knowing it will destroy him and being vain about it. I think it's a really good performance. And it actually won a prize from the LA Film Critics, and I suspect he'll be getting an Oscar nomination. Among women, there are two performances that are particularly outstanding, I think. One is by Hilary Swank, who plays Brandintina, the young woman who passes herself off as a guy in the film Boys Don't Cry. I don't think it's a brilliant performance, but it's an extraordinarily good performance as someone playing a different gender and pulling it off with enormous grace and style. My favorite female performance of the year, though, was by Kate Winslet in the Jane Campion film Holy Smoke, where she plays a young woman who gets involved with a Krishna cult and then has to be deprogrammed by Harvey Keitel. And she is extraordinarily brave and passionate and intelligent and sexual in the film. It's a marvelous performance by someone who may be our best young actress. I mean, it's a genuinely great performance, but because most people won't have seen it, once again, it probably won't get nominated for awards. If I had to guess, I would think that Hilary Swank would probably win the Oscar for Best Actress.
Fresh Air film critic John Powers is with us. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. Well, John, to mark the end of the century, the first real century of movies, we've asked you to put together your desert island films, what 10 films you'd want to be able to screen if you were on a desert island with a projector or a VCR and a place to plug it into. So what would be on your desert island list of films?
Yes. Well, the funny thing about a desert island list of films is that there are certain films which you know should be on that you won't have on. Not to reveal more about me than you want to know, but if you were looking for the Rosetta Stone for my psyche, the thing that would explain who I am more than any other movie, you would probably have to put Dr. No on my desert island list. But
Wait, now why is that? I mean, you are neither a debonair spy, nor do you have lots of gadgets.
No. I think that I saw it when I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, and it was one of the first films that gave me an inkling of the fantasies of adulthood, which would involve travel to exotic places, having adventures.
Chicks.
And being masterful with babes.
Yeah.
Yes. And really, there was a way in which that somehow shaped my consciousness and made me want to escape the kind of life I was living in the Midwest and get out to a bigger, more exotic world than I lived in. And it's a film that did influence me enormously in that way.
And probably made you want to have your own theme music accompanying you.
It did. It did. I know that when I was younger, I wanted to be a spy. As I grew older, I realized there were certain ethical difficulties in doing that. But at the time, it just seemed wonderful to, you know, to get out of your wetsuit and be standing there in a tuxedo, and have every woman want you, and get to fly all over the world and do cool things. And that's part of what the promise of the movies has always been, really, which is that you are an ordinary person who's seeing up on the screen some elaborate version of your inner life. And for me, Dr. No was the one that did that. I can't take it with me to a desert island because I've seen it again recently, and my remembered version is so much better than the actual film that I would simply be depressed. It would not be a giddy Proustian moment for me to see this film, but just sort of it would make me feel dingy and old, so I wouldn't take it. The other film I wouldn't take, but which I love far more than I should perhaps, is Groundhog Day, one of my favorite films of the 90s. But I realized that if you were on a desert island, if you took Groundhog Day, it would somehow seem too realistic. You know, you would wake up every day and be having the same day, and I can't imagine wanting to see Groundhog Day under those circumstances. Anyway, the 10 films that I chose, and these are not in any way supposed to be the best films of the century or films that I think you ought to see. These are the 10 I would take with me. First is His Girl Friday by Howard Hawks, made in 1940. Second, Shop Around the Corner, an Ernst Lubitsch film from 1940 also. North by Northwest, the Alfred Hitchcock film with Cary Grant. Rio Bravo, the Howard Hawks film with John Wayne and Dean Martin. An Autumn Afternoon by Yasujiro Ozu, the great Japanese director. Then I'm cheating here and putting The Godfather Saga so that I can actually have Godfather 1 and 2 only count as one film for my desert island treat. Then a couple films that probably most people won't be interested in, but that I like a lot. One is The Passenger by Michelangelo Antonioni, and the next is called Sans Soleil by the French director Chris Marker. And then I end, oddly enough, and this may say something again about the way my interests have changed, with two films from Asia. One is a Taiwanese film called The Time to Live and The Time to Die by Ho Xiao Shen, who I think is the greatest filmmaker working today, and Chungking Express by the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai, which is a film that just always makes me happy.
Oh, interesting. Now, the early films on this list, His Girl Friday and The Shop Around the Corner, at what point in your life did you see them?
I think I saw these films perhaps when I was a teenager on television. I didn't see them in a cinema when I was going to Oberlin College and saw them at the Film Society. But, you know, there was a time in this country where you would actually turn on conventional television, you know, regular broadcast TV, and they would be showing old classic movies. And so I saw both His Girl Friday and Shop Around the Corner then and instantly fell in love with them. I mean, they are, you know, from the glory period of Hollywood, and they have a kind of life and energy that Hollywood comedies really haven't had for the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, His Girl Friday is probably the funniest American comedy, with brilliant overlapping dialogue, fabulous farce lines, and performance by Cary Grant, which thrills me each time I see it. If I could move around the world a tenth as well as he moves around the frame of that movie, I would be delighted. And then Shop Around the Corner, I think, is one of the most perfect films ever made. An absolutely heartbreaking romantic comedy that was turned into the idiot film You've Got Mail, but that if you see the original, it's one of the most beautiful of all films.
I'm glad that you chose a couple of movies that you were first exposed to on television, because I think for many years, television has been a great repertory cinema house, which has become particularly valuable now that there are very few repertory cinema houses. I know we can rent the stuff on video, but sometimes it's nice to stumble into a movie that you never would have thought of renting on video.
Yes, and it's funny. When I was years ago, I was going to graduate school at Stanford, and I got into this weird habit late at night of watching a thing called Jay Brown's a guy named Jay Brown, who ran a place called Spartan Dodge on Stevens Creek Boulevard in San Jose. His slogan was "Where the Price Slasher Lives." He used to have an all-night movie show. And I used to watch it so much, I can still remember his advertisements 25 years later. And they would show old Warner Brothers classics all night. And my life took such a weird turn that I began skipping all my classes at Stanford during the day and staying up all night watching old movies and discovering all sorts of stuff that I had never seen before. And even though I'd been a film student as an undergraduate at Oberlin, I just hadn't seen the dozens and dozens and dozens of great old movies. And I would stay up all night every night and watch them. And really now when I go to this, you know, and I loved them on TV in a way that I didn't really love them when I saw them in the theater, because I discovered them on TV. And I've always found it strange that people would be so puritanical about the discovery of a movie on television. Of course a movie's better seen in a movie theater, but sometimes it's not, because sometimes you don't want to have to get on the subway and ride for half an hour, or sometimes you don't want to have to drive 40 minutes, or sometimes you don't want to have to plan to get babysitting to go see a film, that will take the joy out of a film. But if it's on TV and you turn it on and it's there right before you, it can be so great, and that's cinema too.
Now, one of the films on this Desert Island list, North by Northwest, got re-released this year, and I guess a restored version. That's been a nice recent phenomenon, the restoration of some films and their re-release so that you could see beautiful new prints in a movie theater on a large screen.
Oh, yeah, no, see, it's wonderful because you get the great restored prints and you get to see them in their pristine form. You know, because someone like Alfred Hitchcock thought a lot about how his movies looked. So it's really nice to see them done perfectly. And then you often get the wonderful transfers to, these days, DVD, which allow you to do stuff you could never do before. In fact, on my Laserdisc, although it will also be available on the DVD, of North by Northwest, there's a moment late in the film where someone pretends to shoot someone. I won't say who in case people haven't seen the film. But if you slow it down on Laserdisc or DVD, you can see that in the background, one of the extras, a little boy, is putting his fingers in his ears even before the person fires the gun, because he knows the sound of the gunfire is going to come. So that when you watch it, you can actually see a mistake in the film because you're able to watch it on the new technology. And I think one of the pleasures of some of the films on this list are that you can use the modern technology of DVD to enjoy the film even more. A film like Sans Soleil, which I mentioned, is a diaristic film by this great French director, Chris Marker, who more or less has traveled around the world and sent back postcards from around the world. This is a film, a lot of which takes place in Tokyo. But it's the kind of film where you'd want to stop, look at the image, think a little bit, and then move on. And so if I had my DVD player and my copy of Sans Soleil, I would actually do that, because Chris Marker, unlike lots of directors, is someone who wants you to think about what he's doing, wander around a little bit. He doesn't care about catching you up in the emotion of something in the way that, say, a Star Wars movie would. He wants you to enjoy, reflect. He doesn't care if you walk away. And that's one of the great things about the new technologies.
Well, John, let's look at the year 2000 for a moment. Should we be braced for a whole spate of movies exploiting the new millennium?
I don't know. I think somehow we might get new millennium, although I think people were probably more interested in the apocalyptic end of the last millennium. Maybe because it takes less imagination to think of how the millennium will end, you know, it will blow up or, you know, somehow go bad, than to imagine the positive side of what could be happening along the way. I think what we should be more likely to look forward to in the next year or so are the versions of things that we saw this year that were successful. I was having lunch with a screenwriter yesterday who was saying that he'd just been talking to one of the most successful production companies in Hollywood. And what everybody there was saying was, where's the next Double Jeopardy? You know, because what everybody looked at Double Jeopardy was that there was this movie with no really huge stars that made $1 zillion. So how can we do that again? Similarly, every place in Hollywood is developing some version of something like Sixth Sense, because people say, oh, people like supernatural stories that have some feeling to them. Blair Witch also did that. So now everyone's going to be copying that. So I suspect that if you really want to know what you're going to get in the next year, look back over the last year and a half, see what was successful, and that will be the template. There'll be lots of films that are rotten versions of There's Something About Mary. There'll be lots of versions that are rotten versions of American Pie. There'll be lots of films that are rotten versions of Double Jeopardy and Sixth Sense.
Well, John, I wish you a very happy new year.
Yes, you too, Terry.
And I want to thank you for being with us today, and happy new year.
Yes, happy new year, Terry.
John Powers is film critic for Fresh Air and Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.